ego. It endows the world and the ego with a heaviness and an absolute importance that makes you take yourself and the world very seriously. The play of form is then misperceived as a struggle for survival. And when that is your perception, it becomes your reality. The many things that happen, the many forms that life takes on, are of an ephemeral nature. They are all fleeting. Things, bodies and egos, events, situations, thoughts, emotions, desires, ambitions, fears, drama, they come, pretend to be all important, and before you know it, they are gone, dissolved into the nothingness out of which they came. Were they ever real? Were they ever more than a dream? The dream of form? When we wake up in the morning, the night's dream dissolves, and we say, "Oh, it was only a dream. It wasn't real." But something in the dream must have been real, otherwise it could not be. When death approaches, we may look back on our life and wonder if it was just another dream. Even now, you may look back on last year's vacation or yesterday's drama and see that it is very similar to last night's dream. There's the dream, and there's the dreamer of the dream. The dream is a short-lived play of forms. It is the world. Relatively real, but not absolutely real. Then there's the dreamer, the absolute reality in which the forms come and go. The dreamer is not the person. The person is part of the dream. The dreamer is the substratum in which the dream appears, that which makes the dream possible. It is the absolute behind the relative, the timeless behind time, the consciousness in and behind form. The dreamer is consciousness itself, who you are. To awaken within the dream is our purpose now. When we are awake within the dream, the ego-created earth drama comes to an end, and a more benign and wondrous dream arises. This is the new earth. Going beyond limitation. In each person's life there comes a time when he or she pursues growth and expansion on the level of form. This is when you strive to overcome limitations such as a physical weakness or financial scarcity, when you acquire new skills and knowledge, or through creative action bring something new into this world that is life-enhancing for yourself as well as others. This may be a piece of music, or a work of art, a book, a service you provide, a function you perform, a business or organization that you set up or make a vital contribution to. When you are present, when your attention is fully in the now, that presence will flow into and transform what you do. There will be quality and power in it. You are present when what you are doing is not primarily a means to an end, money, prestige, winning, but fulfilling in itself, when there is joy and aliveness in what you do. And, of course, you cannot be present unless you become friendly with the present moment. That is the basis for effective action, uncontaminated by negativity. Form means limitation. We are here not only to experience limitation, but also to grow in consciousness by going beyond limitation. Some limitations can be overcome on an external level. There may be other limitations in your life that you have to learn to live with. They can only be overcome internally. Everyone will encounter them sooner or later. Those limitations either keep you trapped in egoic reaction, which means intense unhappiness, or you rise above them internally by uncompromising surrender to what is. That is what they are here to teach. The surrendered state of consciousness opens up the vertical dimension in your life, the dimension of depth. Something will then come forth from that dimension into this world, something of infinite value that otherwise would have remained unmanifested. Some people who surrendered to severe limitation become healers or spiritual teachers. Others work selflessly to lessen human suffering or bring some creative gift into this world. In the late 70s, I would have lunch every day with one or two friends in the cafeteria of the Graduate Center at Cambridge University where I was studying. A man in a wheelchair would sometimes sit at a nearby table, usually accompanied by three or four people. One day, when he was sitting at a table directly opposite me, I could not help but look at him more closely, and I was shocked by what I saw. He seemed almost totally paralyzed. His body was emaciated, his head permanently slumped forward. One of the people accompanying him was carefully putting food in his mouth, a great deal of which would fall out again and be caught on a small plate another man was holding under his chin. Occasionally, the wheelchair-bound man would produce unintelligible croaking sounds, and someone would hold an ear close to his mouth and then, amazingly, would interpret what he was trying to say. Later, I asked my friend whether he knew who he was. "Of course," he said. "He is a professor of mathematics, and the people with him are his graduate students. He has motor neuron disease, which progressively paralyzes every part of the body. He has been given 5 years at the most. It must be the most dreadful fate that can befall a human being." A few weeks later, as I was leaving the building, he was coming in, and when I held the door open for his electric wheelchair to come through, our eyes met. With surprise, I saw that his eyes were clear. There was no trace in them of unhappiness. I knew immediately he had relinquished resistance. He was living in surrender. A number of years later, when buying a newspaper at a kiosk, I was amazed to see him on the front page of a popular international news magazine. Not only was he still alive, but he had by then become the world's most famous theoretical physicist, Stephen Hawking. There was a beautiful line in the article that confirmed what I had sensed when I had looked into his eyes many years earlier. Commenting upon his life, he said, now with the help of a voice synthesizer, "Who could have wished for more?" The joy of being. Unhappiness or negativity is a disease on our planet. What pollution is on the outer level is negativity on the inner. It is everywhere, not just in places where people don't have enough, but even more so where they have more than enough. Is that surprising? No. The affluent world is even more deeply identified with form, more lost in content, more trapped in ego. People believe themselves to be dependent on what happens for their happiness, that is to say, dependent on form. They don't realize that what happens is the most unstable thing in the universe. It changes constantly. They look upon the present moment as either marred by something that has happened and shouldn't have, or as deficient because of something that has not happened but should have. And so they miss the deeper perfection that is inherent in life itself, a perfection that is always already here, that lies beyond what is happening or not happening, beyond form. Accept the present moment and find the perfection that is deeper than any form and untouched by time. The joy of being, which is the only true happiness, cannot come to you through any form, possession, achievement, person, or event, through anything that happens. That joy cannot come to you, ever. It emanates from the formless dimension within you, from consciousness itself, and thus is one with who you are. Allowing the diminishment of the ego. The ego is always on guard against any kind of perceived diminishment. Automatic ego repair mechanisms come into effect to restore the mental form of me. When someone blames or criticizes me, that to the ego is a diminishment of self, and it will immediately attempt to repair its diminished sense of self through self-justification, defense, or blaming. Whether the other person is right or wrong is irrelevant to the ego. It is much more interested in self-preservation than in the truth. This is the preservation of the psychological form of me. Even such a normal thing as shouting something back when another driver calls you idiot is an automatic and unconscious ego repair mechanism. One of the most common ego repair mechanisms is anger, which causes a temporary but huge ego inflation. All repair mechanisms make perfect sense to the ego, but are actually dysfunctional. Those that are most extreme in their dysfunction are physical violence and self-delusion in the form of grandiose fantasies. A powerful spiritual practice is consciously to allow the diminishment of ego when it happens, without attempting to restore it. I recommend that you experiment with this from time to time. For example, when someone criticizes you, blames you, or calls you names, instead of immediately retaliating or defending yourself, do nothing. Allow the self-image to remain diminished and become alert to what that feels like deep inside you. For a few seconds, it may feel uncomfortable, as if you had shrunk in size. Then you may sense an inner spaciousness that feels intensely alive. You haven't been diminished at all. In fact, you have expanded. You may then come to an amazing realization. When you are seemingly diminished in some way and remain in absolute non-reaction, not just externally but also internally, you realize that nothing real has been diminished, that through becoming less, you become more. When you no longer defend or attempt to strengthen the form of yourself, you step out of identification with form, with mental self-image. Through becoming less, in the ego's perception, you in fact undergo an expansion and make room for being to come forward. True power, who you are beyond form, can then shine through the apparently weakened form. This is what Jesus means when he says, deny yourself, or turn the other cheek. This does not mean, of course, that you invite abuse or turn yourself into a victim of unconscious people. Sometimes a situation may demand that you tell someone to back off in no uncertain terms. Without egoic defensiveness, there will be power behind your words, yet no reactive force. If necessary, you can also say no to someone firmly and clearly, and it will be what I call a high-quality no that is free of all negativity. If you are content with being nobody in particular, content not to stand out, you align yourself with the power of the universe. What looks like weakness to the ego is in fact the only true strength. This spiritual truth is diametrically opposed to the values of our contemporary culture and the way it conditions people to behave. Instead of trying to be a mountain, teaches the ancient Tao Te Ching, be the valley of the universe. In this way, you are restored to wholeness and so all things will come to you. Similarly, Jesus, in one of his parables, teaches that when you are invited, go and sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Another aspect of this practice is to refrain from attempting to strengthen the self by showing off, wanting to stand out, be special, make an impression, or demand attention. It may include occasionally refraining from expressing your opinion when everybody is expressing his or hers, and seeing what that feels like. As without, so within. When you look up at the clear sky at night, you may easily realize a truth at once utterly simple and extraordinarily profound. What is it that you see? The moon, planets, stars, the luminous band of the Milky Way, perhaps a comet, or even the neighboring Andromeda galaxy 2 million light years away. Yes, but if you simplify even more, what do you see? Objects floating in space. So what does the universe consist of? Objects and space. If you don't become speechless when looking out into space on a clear night, you are not really looking, not aware of the totality of what is there. You are probably only looking at the objects and perhaps seeking to name them. If you have ever experienced a sense of awe when looking into space, perhaps even felt a deep reverence in the face of this incomprehensible mystery, it means you must have relinquished for a moment your desire to explain and label, and have become aware not only of the objects in space, but of the infinite depths of space itself. You must have become still enough inside to notice the vastness in which these countless worlds exist. The feeling of awe is not derived from the fact that there are billions of worlds out there, but the depths that contains them all. You cannot see space, of course, nor can you hear, touch, taste, or smell it. So how do you even know it exists? This logical-sounding question already contains a fundamental error. The essence of space is no-thingness, so it doesn't exist in the normal sense of the word. Only things, forms, exist. Even calling it space can be misleading because by naming it, you make it into an object. Let us put it like this. There is something within you that has an affinity with space. That is why you can be aware of it. Aware of it? That's not totally true either, because how can you be aware of space if there's nothing there to be aware of? The answer is both simple and profound. When you are aware of space, you are not really aware of anything except awareness itself, the inner space of consciousness. Through you, the universe is becoming aware of itself. When the eye finds nothing to see, that no-thingness is perceived as space. When the ear finds nothing to hear, that no-thingness is perceived as stillness. When the senses, which are designed to perceive form, meet an absence of form, the formless consciousness that lies behind perception and makes all perception, all experience possible, is no longer obscured by form. When you contemplate the unfathomable depths of space, or listen to the silence in the early hours just before sunrise, something within you resonates with it as if in recognition. You then sense the vast depths of space as your own depths, and you know that precious stillness that has no form to be more deeply who you are than any of the things that make up the content of your life. The Upanishads, the ancient scriptures of India, point to the same truth with these words. What cannot be seen with the eye, but that whereby the eye can see. know that alone to be Brahman the spirit, and not what people he adore. What cannot be heard with the ear, but that whereby the ear can hear? Know that alone to be Brahman the spirit, and not what people here adore. What cannot be thought with the mind, but that whereby the mind can think? Know that alone to be Brahman the spirit, and not what people here adore. God, the scripture is saying, is formless consciousness and the essence of who you are. Everything else is form, is what people here adore. The twofold reality of the universe, which consists of things and space, thingness and no-thingness, is also your own. A sane, balanced, and fruitful human life is a dance between the two dimensions that make up reality, form and space. Most people are so identified with the dimension of form, with sense perceptions, thoughts, and emotion, that the vital hidden half is missing from their lives. Their identification with form keeps them trapped in ego. What you see, hear, feel, touch, or think about is only one half of reality, so to speak. It is form. In the teaching of Jesus, it is simply called the world, and the other dimension is the kingdom of heaven, or eternal life. Just as space enables all things to exist, and just as without silence there could be no sound, you would not exist without the vital formless dimension that is the essence of who you are. We could say God, if the word had not been so misused. I prefer to call it being. Being is prior to existence. Existence is form, content, what happens. Existence is the foreground of life. Being is the background, as it were. The collective disease of humanity is that people are so engrossed in what happens, so hypnotized by the world of fluctuating forms, so absorbed in the content of their lives, they have forgotten the essence, that which is beyond content, beyond form, beyond thought. They are so consumed by time that they have forgotten eternity, which is their origin, their home, their destiny. Eternity is the living reality of who you are. Some years ago, when visiting China, I came upon a stupa on a mountaintop near Guilin. It had writing embossed in gold on it, and I asked my Chinese host what it meant. "It means Buddha," he said. "Why are there two characters rather than one?" I asked. "One," he explained, "means man. The other means no. And the two together means Buddha." I stood there in awe. The character for Buddha already contained the whole teaching of the Buddha, and for those who have eyes to see, the secret of life. Here are the two dimensions that make up reality, thingness and no-thingness, form and the denial of form, which is the recognition that form is not who you are. Chapter 8. The Discovery of Inner Space. According to an ancient Sufi story, there lived a king in some Middle Eastern land who was continuously torn between happiness and despondency. The slightest thing would cause him great upset or provoke an intense reaction, and his happiness would quickly turn into disappointment and despair. A time came when the king finally got tired of himself and of life, and he began to seek a way out. He sent for a wise man who lived in his kingdom, and who was reputed to be enlightened. When the wise man came, the king said to him, "I want to be like you. Can you give me something that will bring balance, serenity, and wisdom into my life? I will pay any price you ask. The wise man said, I may be able to help you, but the price is so great that your entire kingdom would not be sufficient payment for it. Therefore it will be a gift to you if you will honor it. The king gave his assurances, and the wise man left. A few weeks later, he returned and handed the king an ornate box carved in jade. The king opened the box and found a simple gold ring inside. Some letters were inscribed on the ring. The inscription read, This, too, will pass. What is the meaning of this? Asked the king. The wise man said, Wear this ring always. Whatever happens, before you call it good or bad, touch this ring and read the inscription. That way you will always be at peace. This, too, will pass. What is it about these simple words that makes them so powerful? Looking at it superficially, it would seem, while those words may provide some comfort in a bad situation, they would also diminish the enjoyment of the good things in life. Don't be too happy, because it won't last. This seems to be what they are saying when applied in a situation that is perceived as good. The full import of these words becomes clear when we consider them in the context of two other stories that we encountered earlier. The story of the Zen master, whose only response was always, Is that so? Shows the good that comes through inner non-resistance to events, that is to say, being at one with what happens. The story of the man, whose comment was invariably a laconic, maybe, illustrates the wisdom of non-judgment, and the story of the ring points to the fact of impermanence which, when recognized, leads to non-attachment. Non-resistance, non-judgment, and non-attachment are the three aspects of true freedom and enlightened living. Those words inscribed on the ring are not telling you that you should not enjoy the good in your life, nor are they merely meant to provide some comfort in times of suffering. They have a deeper purpose, to make you aware of the fleetingness of every situation, which is due to the transience of all forms, good or bad. When you become aware of the transience of all forms, your attachment to them lessens, and you disidentify from them to some extent. Being detached does not mean that you cannot enjoy the good that the world has to offer. In fact, you enjoy it more. Once you see and accept the transience of all things, and the inevitability of change, you can enjoy the pleasures of the world while they last, without fear of loss or anxiety about the future. When you are detached, you gain a higher vantage point from which to view the events in your life, instead of being trapped inside them. You become like an astronaut who sees the planet Earth surrounded by the vastness of space, and realizes a paradoxical truth. The Earth is precious and at the same time insignificant. The recognition that this too will pass brings detachment, and with detachment another dimension comes into your life, inner space. Through detachment, as well as non-judgment and inner non-resistance, you gain access to that dimension. When you are no longer totally identified with forms, consciousness, who you are, becomes freed from its imprisonment in form. This freedom is the arising of inner space. It comes as a stillness, a subtle peace deep within you, even in the face of something seemingly bad. This, too, will pass. Suddenly, there's space around the event. There's also space around the emotional highs and lows, even around pain. And above all, there is space between your thoughts. And from that space emanates a peace that is not of this world, because this world is form, and the peace is space. This is the peace of God. Now you can enjoy and honor the things of this world without giving them an importance and significance they don't have. You can participate in the dance of creation and be active without attachment to outcome and without placing unreasonable demands upon the world. Fulfill me. Make me happy. Make me feel safe. Tell me who I am. The world cannot give you those things. And when you no longer have such expectations, all self-created suffering comes to an end. All such suffering is due to an overvaluation of form and an unawareness of the dimension of inner space. When that dimension is present in your life, you can enjoy things, experiences, and the pleasures of the senses without losing yourself in them, without inner attachment to them. That is to say, without becoming addicted to the world. The words, "this too will pass," are pointers towards reality. In pointing to the impermanence of all forms, by implication, they are also pointing to the eternal. Only the eternal in you can recognize the impermanent as impermanent. When the dimension of space is lost, or rather not known, the things of the world assume an absolute importance, a seriousness and heaviness that in truth they do not have. When the world is not viewed from the perspective of the formless, it becomes a threatening place, and ultimately a place of despair. The Old Testament prophet must have felt this when he wrote, "All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it." Object consciousness and space consciousness. Most people's lives are cluttered up with things. Material things, things to do, things to think about. Their lives are like the history of humanity, which Winston Churchill defined as "one damn thing after another." Their minds are filled up with a clutter of thoughts, one thought after another. This is the dimension of object consciousness that is many people's predominant reality, and that is why their lives are so out of balance. Object consciousness needs to be balanced by space consciousness for sanity to return to our planet, and for humanity to fulfill its destiny. The arising of space consciousness is the next stage in the evolution of humanity. Space consciousness means that in addition to being conscious of things, which always comes down to sense perceptions, thoughts, and emotions, there's an undercurrent of awareness. Awareness implies that you are not only conscious of things, objects, but you're also conscious of being conscious. If you can sense an alert inner stillness in the background while things happen in the foreground, that's it. This dimension is there in everyone, but most people are completely unaware of it. Sometimes I point to it by saying, "Can you feel your own presence?" Space consciousness represents not only freedom from ego, but also from dependency on the things of this world, from materialism and materiality. It is the spiritual dimension which alone can give transcendent and true meaning to this world. Whenever you are upset about an event, a person, or situation, the real cause is not the event, person, or situation, but a loss of true perspective that only space can provide. You are trapped in object consciousness, unaware of the timeless inner space of consciousness itself. The words, "this too will pass," when used as a pointer, can restore awareness of that dimension to you. Another pointer to the truth in you is contained in the following statement. I am never upset for the reason I think. Falling below and rising above thought. When you are very tired, you may become more peaceful, more relaxed than in your usual state. This is because thinking is subsiding, and so you can't remember your mind-made problematic self anymore. You are moving towards sleep. When you drink alcohol or take certain drugs, provided they don't trigger your pain body, you may also feel more relaxed, more carefree, and perhaps more alive for a while. You may start singing and dancing, which since ancient times are expressions of the joy of life. Because you are less burdened by your mind, you can glimpse the joy of being. Perhaps this is the reason alcohol is also called spirit. But there's a high price to pay. Unconsciousness. Instead of rising above thought, you have fallen below it. A few more drinks, and you will have regressed to the vegetable realm. Space consciousness has little to do with being spaced out. Both states are beyond thought. This they have in common. The fundamental difference, however, is that in the former you rise above thought, in the latter you fall below it. One is the next step in the evolution of human consciousness, the other a regression to a stage we left behind eons ago. Television. Watching television is the favorite leisure activity, or rather non-activity, for millions of people around the world. The average American, by the time he is 60 years old, will have spent 15 years staring at the TV screen. In many other countries, the figures are similar. Many people find watching TV relaxing. Observe yourself closely and you will find that the longer the screen remains the focus of your attention, the more your thought activity becomes suspended, and for long periods you are watching the talk show, game show, sitcom, or even commercials, with almost no thought being generated by your mind. Not only do you not remember your problems anymore, but you become temporarily free of yourself. And what could be more relaxing than that? So does TV watching create inner space? Does it cause you to be present? Unfortunately, it does not. Although for long periods your mind may not be generating any thoughts, it has linked into the thought activity of the television show. It has linked up with the TV version of the collective mind and is thinking its thoughts. Your mind is inactive only in the sense that it is not producing thoughts. It is, however, continuously absorbing thoughts and images that come through the TV screen. This induces a trance-like passive state of heightened susceptibility, not unlike hypnosis. That is why it lends itself to manipulation of public opinion, as politicians and special interest groups, as well as advertisers, know, and will pay millions of dollars to catch you in that state of receptive unawareness. They want their thoughts to become your thoughts, and usually they succeed. So when watching television, the tendency is for you to fall below thought, not rise above it. Television has this in common with alcohol and certain other drugs. While it provides some relief from your mind, you again pay a high price, loss of consciousness. Like those drugs, it too has a strong addictive quality. You reach for the remote control to switch off, and instead find yourself going through all the channels. Half an hour or an hour later, you are still watching, still going through the channels. The off button is the only one your finger seems unable to press. You are still watching. usually not because anything of interest has caught your attention, but precisely because there is nothing of interest to watch. Once you're hooked, the more trivial, the more meaningless it is, the more addictive it becomes. If it were interesting, thought-provoking, it would stimulate your mind into thinking for itself again, which is more conscious and therefore preferable to a TV-induced trance. Your attention would therefore no longer be totally held captive by the images on the screen. The content of the program, if there is a certain quality to it, can to some extent counteract and sometimes even undo the hypnotic, mind-numbing effect of the medium of television. There are some programs that have been extremely helpful to many people, have changed their lives for the better, opened their heart, made them more conscious. Even some comedy shows, although they may be about nothing in particular, can be unintentionally spiritual by showing a caricature version of human folly and the ego. They teach us not to take anything too seriously, to approach life in a light-hearted way, and above all, they teach by making us laugh. Laughter is extraordinarily liberating as well as healing. Most of television, however, is as yet controlled by people who are totally controlled by the ego. And so the TV's hidden agenda becomes control of you by putting you to sleep, that is to say, making you unconscious. Yet there's enormous and still largely unexplored potential in the medium of television. Avoid watching programs and commercials that assault you with a rapid succession of images that change every 2 or 3 seconds or less. Excessive TV watching, and those programs in particular, are largely responsible for attention deficit disorder, a mental dysfunction now affecting millions of children worldwide. A short attention span makes all your perceptions and relationships shallow and unsatisfying. Whatever you do, whatever action you perform in that state, lacks quality, because quality requires attention. Frequent and prolonged TV watching not only makes you unconscious, it also induces passivity and drains you of energy. Therefore, rather than watching at random, choose the programs you want to see. Whenever you remember to do so, feel the aliveness inside your body as you watch. Alternatively, be aware of your breathing from time to time. Look away from the screen at regular intervals so that it does not completely take possession of your visual sense. Don't turn up the volume any higher than necessary so that the TV doesn't overwhelm you on the auditory level. Use the mute button during commercials. Make sure you don't go to sleep immediately after switching off the set, or, even worse, fall asleep with the set still on. Recognizing inner space. Space between thoughts is probably already arising sporadically in your life, and you may not even know it. A consciousness mesmerized by experiences and conditioned to identify exclusively with form, that is to say, object consciousness, finds it at first almost impossible to become aware of space. This ultimately means that you cannot become aware of yourself because you're always aware of something else. You're continuously distracted by form. Even when you seem to be aware of yourself, you have made yourself into an object, a thought form. And so what you are aware of is a thought, not yourself. When you hear of inner space, you may start seeking it, and, because you are seeking it as if you were looking for an object or for an experience, you cannot find it. This is the dilemma of all those who are seeking spiritual realization or enlightenment. Hence, Jesus said, "The kingdom of God is not coming with signs to be observed. Nor will they say, 'Lo, here it is,' or 'There.' For behold, the kingdom of God is in the midst of you." If you are not spending all of your waking life in discontent, worry, anxiety, depression, despair, or consumed by other negative states, if you're able to enjoy simple things like listening to the sound of the rain or the wind, if you can see the beauty of clouds moving across the sky, or be alone at times without feeling lonely or needing the mental stimulus of entertainment, if you find yourself treating a complete stranger with heartfelt kindness without wanting anything from him or her, it means that a space has opened up, no matter how briefly, in the otherwise incessant stream of thinking that is the human mind. When this happens, there's a sense of well-being, of alive peace, even though it may be subtle. The intensity will vary from a perhaps barely noticeable background sense of contentment to what the ancient sages of India called ananda, the bliss of being. Because you've been conditioned to pay attention only to form, you're probably not aware of it except indirectly. For example, there's a common element in the ability to see beauty, to appreciate simple things, to enjoy your own company, or to relate to other people with loving kindness. This common element is a sense of contentment, peace, and aliveness that is the invisible background without which these experiences would not be possible. Whenever there's beauty, kindness, the recognition of the goodness of simple things in your life, look for the background to that experience within yourself. But don't look for it as if you were looking for something. You cannot pin it down and say, "Now I have it," or grasp it mentally and define it in some way. It is like the cloudless sky. It has no form. It is space. It is stillness, the sweetness of being, and infinitely more than these words, which are only pointers. When you are able to sense it directly within yourself, it deepens. So when you appreciate something simple, a sound, a sight, a touch, when you see beauty, when you feel loving kindness towards another, sense the inner spaciousness that is the source and background to that experience. Many poets and sages throughout the ages have observed that true happiness, I call it the joy of being, is found in simple, seemingly unremarkable things. Most people, in their restless search for something significant to happen to them, continuously miss the insignificant, which may not be insignificant at all. The philosopher Nietzsche, in a rare moment of deep stillness, wrote, "For happiness, how little suffices for happiness. The least thing precisely, the gentlest thing, the lightest thing, a lizard's rustling, a breath, a whisk, an eye glance, little makes up the best happiness. Be still." Why is it the least thing that makes up the best happiness? Because true happiness is not caused by the thing or event, although this is how it first appears. The thing or event is so subtle, so unobtrusive, that it takes up only a small part of your consciousness. And the rest is inner space, consciousness itself unobstructed by form. Inner space consciousness and who you are in your essence are one and the same. In other words, the form of little things leaves room for inner space. And it is from inner space, the unconditioned consciousness itself, that true happiness, the joy of being, emanates. To be aware of little, quiet things, however, you need to be quiet inside. A high degree of alertness is required. Be still. Look. Listen. Be present. Here's another way of finding inner space. Become conscious of being conscious. Say or think, I am, and add nothing to it. Be aware of the stillness that follows the I am. Sense your presence, the naked, unveiled, unclothed beingness. It is untouched by young or old, rich or poor, good or bad, or any other attributes. It is the spacious womb of all creation, all form.
End of Disc 6.
Can you hear the mountain stream? A Zen master was walking in silence with one of his disciples along a mountain trail. When they came to an ancient cedar tree, they sat down under it for a simple meal of some rice and vegetables. After the meal, the disciple, a young monk who had not yet found the key to the mystery of Zen, broke the silence by asking the master, "Master, how do I enter Zen?" He was, of course, inquiring how to enter the state of consciousness, which is Zen. The master remained silent. Almost 5 minutes passed while the disciple anxiously waited for an answer. He was about to ask another question when the master suddenly spoke. "Do you hear the sound of that mountain stream?" The disciple had not been aware of any mountain stream. He had been too busy thinking about the meaning of Zen. Now, as he began to listen for the sound, his noisy mind subsided. At first he heard nothing. Then, his thinking gave way to heightened alertness, and suddenly he did hear the hardly perceptible murmur of a small stream in the far distance. "Yes, I can hear it now," he said. The master raised his finger and, with a look in his eyes that in some way was both fierce and gentle, said, "Enter Zen from there." The disciple was stunned. It was his first Satori, a flash of enlightenment. He knew what Zen was without knowing what it was that he knew. They continued on their journey in silence. The disciple was amazed at the aliveness of the world around him. He experienced everything as if for the first time. Gradually, however, he started thinking again. The alert stillness became covered up again by mental noise. And before long he had another question. "Master," he said, "I've been thinking. What would you have said if I hadn't been able to hear the mountain stream?" The master stopped, looked at him, raised his finger and said, "Enter Zen from there." Right action. The ego asks, "How can I make this situation fulfill my needs?" Or, "How can I get to some other situation that will fulfill my needs?" Presence is a state of inner spaciousness. When you are present, you ask, "How do I respond to the needs of this situation, of this moment?" In fact, you don't even need to ask the question. You are still, alert, open to what is. You bring a new dimension into the situation, space. Then you look and you listen. Thus you become one with the situation. When instead of reacting against a situation, you merge with it, the solution arises out of the situation itself. Actually, it is not you, the person, who is looking and listening, but the alert stillness itself. Then, if action is possible or necessary, you take action, or rather, right action happens through you. Right action is action that is appropriate to the whole. When the action is accomplished, the alert, spacious stillness remains. There's nobody who raises his arms in a gesture of triumph, shouting a defiant, "Yay!" There's no one who says, "Look, I did that." All creativity comes out of inner spaciousness. Once the creation has happened and something has come into form, you have to be vigilant so that the notion of me or mine does not arise. If you take credit for what you accomplished, the ego has returned and the spaciousness has become obscured. Perceiving without naming. Most people are only peripherally aware of the world that surrounds them, especially if their surroundings are familiar. The voice in the head absorbs the greater part of their attention. Some people feel more alive when they travel and visit unfamiliar places or foreign countries, because at those times sense perception, experiencing, takes up more of their consciousness than thinking. They become more present. Others remain completely possessed by the voice in the head even then. Their perceptions and experiences are distorted by instant judgments. They haven't really gone anywhere. Only their body is traveling, while they remain where they have always been, in their head. This is most people's reality. As soon as something is perceived, it is named, interpreted, compared with something else, liked, disliked, or called good or bad by the phantom self, the ego. They are imprisoned in thought forms, in object consciousness. You do not awaken spiritually until the compulsive and unconscious naming ceases. Or at least you become aware of it and thus are able to observe it as it happens. It is through this constant naming that the ego remains in place as the unobserved mind. Whenever it ceases, and even when you just become aware of it, there is inner space, and you are not possessed by the mind anymore. Choose an object close to you, a pen, a chair, a cup, a plant, and explore it visually, that is to say, look at it with great interest, almost curiosity. Avoid any objects with strong personal associations that remind you of the past, such as where you bought it, who gave it to you, and so on. Also avoid anything that has writing on it, such as a book or a bottle. It would stimulate thought. Without straining, relaxed but alert, give your complete attention to the object, every detail of it. If thoughts arise, don't get involved in them. It is not the thoughts you are interested in, but the act of perception itself. Can you take the thinking out of the perceiving? Can you look without the voice in your head commenting, drawing conclusions, comparing, or trying to figure something out? After a couple of minutes or so, let your gaze wander around the room or wherever you are, your alert attention lighting up each thing that it rests upon. Then listen to any sounds that may be present. Listen to them in the same way as you looked at the things around you. Some sounds may be natural, water, wind, birds, while others are man-made. Some may be pleasant, others unpleasant. However, don't differentiate between good and bad. Allow each sound to be as it is, without interpretation. Here too, relaxed but alert attention is the key. When you look and listen in this way, you may become aware of a subtle and at first perhaps hardly noticeable sense of calm. Some people feel it as a stillness in the background. Others call it peace. When consciousness is no longer totally absorbed by thinking, some of it remains in its formless, unconditioned, original state. This is inner space. Who is the experiencer? What you see and hear, taste, touch and smell, are, of course, sense objects. They are what you experience. But who is the subject? The experiencer. If you now say, for example, well, of course, I, Jane Smith, senior accountant, 45 years old, divorced, mother of two, American, am the subject, the experiencer. You are mistaken. Jane Smith and whatever else becomes identified with the mental concept of Jane Smith are all objects of experience, not the experiencing subject. Every experience has three possible ingredients: sense perceptions, thoughts or mental images, and emotions. Jane Smith, senior accountant, 45 years old, mother of two, divorced, American. These are all thoughts and therefore part of what you experience the moment you think these thoughts. They, and whatever else you can say and think about yourself, are objects, not the subject. They are experience, not the experiencer. You can add 1,000 more definitions, thoughts, of who you are, and by doing so will certainly increase the complexity of the experience of yourself, as well as your psychiatrist's income, but, in this way, you will not end up with a subject,